Hello, and welcome to Learning English Weekend, the Sunday edition. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz in Washington. It's May 8th, 2016. It was on this day in 1980 that the World Health Organization confirmed the smallpox virus had been eliminated. As many as 500 million people died from the disease in the 20th century. Now, here's what's ahead on today's program. In our weekly education report, Jill Robbins reports on the growing number of students graduating from American high schools who are unprepared for college. Then Anna Mateo will be with us, as she is every Sunday, with Words and Their Stories. This week, she reports on the many influences of playwright William Shakespeare on the English language. And as we always do on the Sunday edition of Learning English Weekend, we will present The Making of a Nation. This week in our series, we take you back to the years after World War I. New technologies were bringing great changes to American society, improving the lives of millions of people. So you can see, as always, we have a lot for you today. Every day of the year, we bring you news from and about America and the world. And every Sunday, we tell you the often surprising and always interesting history of the United States. We are a little different here at VOA Learning English because we exist to help you learn everyday American English. We speak a little slower than normal, and we use words that are easy to understand. Listen to the program, then practice saying the words and sentences the way we do. It's a free and easy way to improve your American English skills every day of the year. We're on the radio, on the web, and we come to you on a podcast. We are wherever you are. We're the voice of America. Recent test results show fewer American high school students were prepared for success in college in 2015. Only 37% of seniors scored at or above proficiency level in reading. The number of seniors scoring at or above the proficiency level for mathematics fell to 25%. More on the test results now from Jill Robbins.
The test is called the National Assessment for Educational Progress, or NAEP. It is also known as the Nation's Report Card. The U.S. Department of Education has used this test to measure the ability of students in several subjects across the country since 1969. The Education Department collected the scores of 13,200 students for the 2015 mathematics test and 18,700 students for the reading test. The department released the results of these two tests in April. The results showed that average mathematics scores have changed little over the past 10 years. But they also showed the average reading score has decreased 5 points since 1992. The National Assessment Governing Board is the organization that administers the test. Bill Bushaw is the executive director of the organization. He told the Wall Street Journal that he was unhappy with the lack of progress in increasing the skills and knowledge of students. "These numbers aren't going the way we want," Bushaw said. "We just have to redouble our efforts to prepare our students to close opportunity gaps." The test is scored into 4 different levels: below basic, basic, proficient, and advanced. But the level that officials consider to be college ready is not completely clear. Andrew Ho is a measurement expert who works at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. He also helps manage the nation's report card. Ho told National Public Radio that being college ready means scoring somewhere between proficient and basic. "This is the major problem of standards," Ho said. "You can come up with a different and seemingly defensible standard every day over coffee." But, Ho said, the nation's report card is the best test for examining how the average student in the U.S. performs. Unlike state tests, all students take the same national test and face the same standards. None are trained on how to take the test. This means officials can measure the skills and knowledge of students rather than their test-taking abilities. One major concern is that high schools are not demanding enough from their students. Despite the decrease in test scores, the Education Department reported the high school graduation rate in America was 82% in 2015. This is the highest graduation rate ever. If you get right down to it, the reading and math required by NAEP, the ACT, the SAT, colleges and careers, is much greater than what high schools are saying is sufficient, Ho told NPR. Another issue is that the number of students scoring at the below basic level is increasing. The number of students scoring below basic in math increased from 35% to 38% between 2013 and 2015. The number of students who scored below basic in reading also increased 3 percentage points to 28% in 2015. I'm Jill Robbins.
Thanks, Jill. Now, if it's Sunday, it's time for Onomateo and Words and Their Stories, one of our most popular programs. Today, she tells us about the effect William Shakespeare's plays have had on the English language.
William Shakespeare is probably the most famous English language writer ever. Historians think Shakespeare was born on April 23rd in 1564. They believe he died exactly 52 years later on the same day. But historians and the rest of us actually know very little about the personal life of Shakespeare. Some researchers even suggest that he did not write all the plays that are credited to him. But let us put all the mystery aside. What we do know is this: the language of Shakespeare is alive and well in modern, everyday English. Even if an English speaker knows nothing about Shakespeare, they will surely know some of his expressions. And I am not talking about sayings like "to be or not to be," or "Wherefore art thou, Romeo?" Most people know those lines come from Shakespeare. The playwright invented many more words and expressions that we continue to use every day. Perhaps this is best explained as a theatrical production. As Shakespeare wrote, "All the world's a stage, and all the men and women merely players." Let's pretend two friends are in a crowded theater. They are waiting for a performance of Shakespeare to begin. One is a Shakespeare buff who knows a lot about the playwright. The other person thinks he knows very little about Shakespeare, but he may know more than he thinks. Before the curtain rises, let's listen to their conversation. "What took you so long? The play is starting soon."
"I wanted to buy something to eat, but that turned out to be a wild goose chase. This theater does not have any food."
"I thought you went home."
"Why would I leave?"
"Because you do not like Shakespeare."
"It's not that I don't like Shakespeare. I just don't know Shakespeare."
"I suspect you know more than you think."
"What do you mean?"
"Well, the term wild goose chase comes from Shakespeare's play, Romeo and Juliet. Years ago, it meant a kind of horse race. But now, it means a hopeless search for something you cannot find."
"Well, I wish you would have told me that this theater doesn't serve food before my wild goose chase. I'm so hungry. A friend has been staying with me for the past month, and he's eating me out of house and home. There's nothing left in my house to eat."
That is another expression from Shakespeare. It comes from the play Henry IV.
"What expression? I'm hungry?"
"No, to eat someone out of house and home. It means that someone eats all the food in your house, like your friend." In Shakespeare's play, Mistress Quickly says to the king, "He hath eaten me out of house and home. He hath put all my substance into that fat belly of his."
"That is exactly what is happening, just like in Henry IV.
So why has your friend been staying with you for so long?"
"He says he got into a little trouble with the law and needs to lie low for a while."
Staying out of sight until trouble passes is great advice. In fact, Shakespeare wrote that advice for Antonio in Much Ado About Nothing. The exact words were, "If he could right himself with quarreling, some of us would lie low."
"When you start talking Shakespeare, I really get lost. It's all Greek to me. I just cannot understand any of it."
"Well, you must understand a little because you use his expressions all the time. It's Greek to me is from the play Julius Caesar. And it's one way to tell someone you don't have a clue what's going on."
"I have to say, I am a little jealous that you know so much about Shakespeare. And I'm not one to fall victim to the green-eyed monster."
"Guess what?"
"Don't tell me. That expression is also from Shakespeare. I thought it came from the fact that feeling bitter kind of makes you feel sick, and sick people often look green."
"You are right. Before Shakespeare's time, the color green was most commonly linked with bad health. In his play Othello, Shakespeare turned the idea of being sick with a disease into a condition, being sick with jealousy."
"You know, there are many other playwrights out there. Shakespeare is not the be-all and end-all of English writers."
"No one ever said he was the most important person in the English-speaking world. But now that you said it, be-all and end-all is my favorite Shakespeare expression. And it comes from my favorite play, Macbeth. As Macbeth is preparing to kill the king, he says, 'That but this blow might be the be-all and the end-all.'"
"I really didn't know that Shakespeare was such an influence on the way we speak today. I just thought he was for old college professors and people who do nothing but go to the theater."
Hey!
Seriously, it is fun to find out that so many of his words and expressions are still used today.
Did you know he even invented the knock-knock joke?
Really?
Knock-knock.
Who's there?
Orange.
Orange who?
Aren't you glad I didn't quote Shakespeare again?
Yes. Yes, I am. Now be quiet. The play is about to start, and I don't want to miss a word.
We hope you enjoyed this special Words in Their Stories celebrating the writer William Shakespeare. Have fun using the Shakespearean expressions that you heard today. I'm Anna Mateo.
Thanks, Anna. Now, as we do every Sunday, we present The Making of a Nation. This week in our series, Harry Monroe and Kay Gallant take us back to the years after World War I, the early 1920s, when new technologies brought great changes to American society and improved the lives of millions of people.
Some of the most important changes came as a result of the automobile and the radio. Automobiles began to be mass-produced. They were low enough in cost so many Americans could buy them. Gasoline was low in cost, too. Together, these developments put America on the move as never before. Automobiles made it easy for Americans to travel. Trucks made it easy for goods to be transported. Many people and businesses moved out of crowded, noisy cities. They moved to open areas outside cities, suburbs.
As automobiles helped Americans spread out, the radio helped bring them closer together. Large networks could broadcast the same radio program to many stations at the same time. Soon, Americans everywhere were listening to the same programs. They laughed at the same jokes, sang the same songs, heard the same news. Another invention that produced big changes in American life was the motion picture.
American inventor Thomas Edison began making short motion pictures at the turn of the century. In 1903, a movie called The Great Train Robbery was the first to tell a complete story. In 1915, D.W. Griffith made a long, serious movie called Birth of a Nation. By the early 1920s, many American towns had a movie theater. Most Americans went to see the movies at least once a week. The movie industry became a big business. People might not know the names of government officials, but they knew the names of every leading actor and actress.
Movies were fun. They provided a change from the day-to-day troubles of life. They also were an important social force. Young Americans tried to copy what they saw in the movies, and they dreamed about faraway places and a different kind of life. A young farm boy could imagine himself as romantic hero Douglas Fairbanks or comedian Charlie Chaplin. A young city girl could imagine herself as the beautiful and brave Mary Pickford. Rich families and poor families saw the same movies. Their children shared the same wish to be like the movie stars. In this way, the son of a banker and the son of a factory worker had much in common. The same was true for people from different parts of the country.
In the early 1920s, Americans also began reading the same publications. The publishing industry used some of the same kinds of mass production methods as the automobile industry. It began producing magazines in larger amounts. It began selling the same magazines all over the country. One of the most widely read magazines was the Saturday Evening Post. In 1902, it sold about 300,000 copies each week. 20 years later, it sold more than 2 million copies each week. Americans everywhere shared the same information and advice in such nationwide magazines. The information was not always correct. The advice was not always good. But the effect was similar to that caused by the automobile and radio. Parts of American society were becoming more alike. They were trying to move toward the same kind of life, economically and socially.
Other industries use the techniques of assembly line production to make their goods, too. They discovered that producing large numbers of goods reduced the cost of each one. One company that expanded in this way was the Atlantic and Pacific Tea Company. It was called A&P for short. The A&P was one of the first large American grocery stores to sell all kinds of food. It sold milk, meat, bread, canned fruits and vegetables, all in the same store. Shopping at the A&P was much faster and easier than going to different stores to get different kinds of food. In 1912, A&P had 400 stores in the United States. About 10 years later, it had more than 11,000 stores. It could buy huge amounts of goods and sell each at a very low price.
Mass production also came to the clothing industry. People began wearing clothes made in factories instead of by a family member or local tailor. Before long, the same kinds of clothes could be found everywhere. Mass production removed some differences that had marked Americans in the past. Prices dropped, so people with little money could still buy nice clothes. It became more difficult to look at Americans and know by their clothes if they were rich or poor.
Social changes also resulted from great progress in medical research. Doctors and scientists reported new developments in the fight against disease. This progress gave most Americans a longer life. In 1900, for example, the average person in the United States could expect to live 49 years. By 1927, the average person could expect to live 59 years.
Life expectancy rates climbed because doctors and scientists developed effective ways to prevent or treat diseases such as tuberculosis, typhoid, diphtheria, and influenza. Yellow fever and smallpox were no longer a threat. One new medicine was insulin. It was used to treat diabetes. A man-made version gave diabetics the insulin their bodies did not have. It cut the death rate from the disease from 70% to about 1%. Doctors and scientists also learned the importance of vitamins to good health. Now they could cure several diseases caused by a lack of vitamins.
Americans in the 1920s lived much better than their fathers and mothers. A man received more pay than in the past, even though he worked fewer hours each day. He lived in a better house with new labor-saving devices. He had a car to drive to work and to take his family on holiday trips. He received a better education than his father. He and his family wore better clothes. They ate healthier foods. The average American in the 1920s had more time for sports and entertainment. He enjoyed listening to the radio and watching movies. He was more informed about national and world events.
Life was good for many Americans as World War I ended and the nation entered the 1920s. But for some, that life was far from perfect. Many Americans did not have the same chances to improve their lives. Black Americans continued to suffer from racism. Society continued to deny them their rights as citizens. Women did not have equal rights either. For example, they could not vote. It was during this time that the United States experienced one of its worst incidents of public hatred. Many people turned strongly against labor unions and leftists. They feared a threat to democracy. The federal government took action against what it called political extremists. Many of the charges were unfair, and innocent lives were harmed. That will be our story next week on The Making of a Nation, on Learning English Weekend, the Sunday edition. This Making of a Nation program was written by Frank Beardsley. It was presented by Harry Monroe and Kay Gallant, and we thank them all. You can find the entire Making of a Nation series online with transcripts, MP3s, podcasts, and images at learningenglish.voanews.com. While you are visiting our website, you can also read and listen to all of the stories that you have just heard on this program. Well, that's Learning English Weekend, the Sunday edition. We hope it has informed and entertained you and has helped you learn everyday American English. Next week on this program, in addition to The Making of a Nation, we'll bring you the latest education news. And Ana Mateo will be here, as always, with words and their stories. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz, reporting from Washington. For all of us here at VOA Learning English, thanks for spending some time with us today. I'll be back tomorrow at this same time to help you learn everyday American English with As It Is Monday, the weekday Learning English broadcast, webcast, and podcast from The Voice of America.